So today is June 30th, 2016. This is a Grand Canyon Historical Society oral history interview. We're at the South Rim Grand Canyon National Park at the Museum Collection. My name is Tom Martin, and with me here is Lisa Goetzman.
My name now is Lisa Kaishan, but my name was Lisa Goetzman.
Thank you. How do you spell Kaishan?
K-A-I-C-H-E-N.
And Goetzman?
G-O-T-T-E-S-M-A-N.
Thank you. And how is it that you're here today?
I'm here because it's the 60th anniversary of the plane crash that killed my father.
Okay.
When I was 5 years old.
Okay. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have a brother, and at the time of the crash, he was 18 months old.
Okay. What was your mother's name?
Her name was Elizabeth McGuire, and my dad called her Mickey.
How did they meet?
Well, they met actually on a blind date when they were with they were with other people on a date. And so the partners kind of, they liked the person that the other person had come with. And it was kind of an interesting story in that she grew up in a Catholic family and he was Jewish. And it was quite a problem for both families when they got together. But I think she thought he was a dashing young ROTC guy at the time, and it was at Western Michigan University where they met. But then he went on to go to Notre Dame and was working on a PhD. I'm not entirely sure if he finished his PhD, but he went on to Notre Dame University and was studying mathematics and working on a PhD. He was, when he died, he was called the lead mathematical analyst at Bendix Corporation. And he died when he was only 30 years old, so quite an achievement at a young age.
Where did they meet, your mom and your
Western family? Michigan University.
Sorry, and so this was
in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
At a party or two
months
after?
I don't know exactly, but I know they were on a double date, and they were attracted to the other person's date, so they got together.
And do you know what year they were married?
Actually, I can tell you, because I wear the ring that was my father's ring. So I don't know if I can read this little teeny writing. I might need to put on my reading glasses, but I believe it was around 1946, and I was born in 51. So let's see if I can read what the ring says. Mickey to Noel, February 14th. And I don't think it has a year. No, but I'm pretty sure it was 1940s. Wait, it is. 214. 44, I think that says.
That's precious.
So, yeah.
Oh. So, if you were going to teach me about your father and his values and your mother and her values, what would you tell me?
Obviously, the fact that they got together, I think. They both believed in love, and they both were independent enough that they were willing to defy cultural norms and endure their parents', displeasure. So I think that they really loved each other very, very much. In fact, I still have love letters that he wrote to her, and I have nude photographs that he took of her, so that was, I haven't figured quite what to do with those, but I thought maybe I'd make a piece of art or something, now that they're both long gone.
So, what were they like?
Parents like as people?
Yeah, did they, were they in civic organizations, did they sing?
Well, again, they died, my dad died when I was only 5, so it's pretty hard to know too much. I know that he remained culturally Jewish, and she remained culturally Catholic, and he was an only child, and his parents, his dad owned a store called American Unclaimed Freight, and I used to go there often when I was young, and it was great because it was, I guess it was unclaimed freight, but it was everything you could imagine, from linoleum to work boots, and used to give me scraps of material and wallpaper books and stuff like that, so I had a lot of fun with the things. And actually, it was my birth, I think, that really brought their families back, you know, that they wanted, you know, the grandchild brought them back.
Nice.
So value-wise, you know, I know he played golf,
okay.
And I know I have some pictures of him playing golf with his buddies, and, you know, I have baby movies of being on the campus of Notre Dame, and my mom posing with me, and, you know, that kind of stuff, and I'm not sure how old we were when we moved to Detroit, so I was born in Indiana. Where he was going to school, and he was teaching at Notre Dame as well. And then we moved to Detroit and lived there for a few years, and I was a pretty spoiled little girl that, you know, had, you know, wonderful Christmas. We celebrated Christmas and Easter, even though we might go to Passover dinner or whatever. We had the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and that kind of thing. And lots of good memories, warm memories of him. I remember I haven't found it, and I'd like to find it. He made a tape for me of his voice singing to me, and I'd love to find that. And if I do, I certainly would share that with the Historical Society.
Oh, that would be precious.
Yeah. And he brought me different things. I have a pennon that he brought me from a trip, and I have a Navajo doll that he brought me from another trip. So,
tell me about those trips.
He traveled a fair amount with business.
Okay.
Yeah, he traveled, and I assume it was out west here. You know, again, I don't know a lot, but. He did fly on business, and I believe these things were brought to me from Arizona, I think. You know, but again, I don't know for sure.
Was he flying to California and back? Because the plane would land in Winslow.
Okay.
And I'm sure there were people selling items there.
Oh, well, that might have been.
While you waited for refueling to happen.
That might have been. Yeah.
So he could have picked them up there.
So he could have.
If he had no business in Arizona, but he was traveling further to the West Coast and then back.
Right, and I don't know, you know, again, a little child doesn't know much about their parents' work lives, you know, so.
Right.
So that's kind of what I know about them. You know, I know they were very much in love. I remember her sitting on his lap and, you know, stuff like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
When your little brother came along, was that pretty seamless for you?
That was pretty seamless, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
and again,
I was glad to have a little brother. And
that's a reflection of good parenting.
Yeah,
how that works.
So, yeah, I do remember asking him who was his favorite, and he kind of said, you know, I don't have a favorite child, and I said, well, I think you know me better, so I'm probably your favorite. So. And I think he said, yeah.
That's cute.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So you were 5 years old. Do you remember how you heard of the accident?
I remember a lot of talk about the plane is missing and then the plane is lost. And, you know, I remember that we had been planning to get him at the airport, and I don't know, you know, I don't know whether there was a call or what, but I remember there was a lot of conversation about that, a lot of people coming to the house, and my not feeling particular concern, because at that age, when something's missing or lost, you know, you find it. So, you know, and then I remember around that whole time, the people that came to the house were many, you know, and were neighbors and all kinds of stuff. And the pediatrician came, and I remember being very scared that he came and hiding because I thought he might give me a shot. So that was kind of my way of thinking about some of these things. I don't recall going to a funeral. I don't think I was included. I think I was, you know, excluded. I do recall going to the grave on a regular basis, because my father did have, evidently enough of him was found, you know, that there is a grave and in a Jewish cemetery. And we would go there pretty regularly, you know, for a number of years, and bring flowers and, you know, that kind of thing. His parents, my grandparents, went every single Sunday, and they took lawn chairs, you know, unless it was winter and too cold. They went and, like, spent their Sunday afternoon sitting in lawn chairs at his grave.
Their only son.
So, their only, yep.
Oh, only
son,
only
child.
Child.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
And what happened to your mother?
She, well, you know, again, from a child's perspective, you know, she didn't talk about it a whole lot. Probably she didn't want to worry us. And ultimately she began dating and stuff like that. And she did get a settlement from, I'm not sure who, I think it was from the suit with, you know, I don't know if it was United or whatever, but she set up college funds for my brother and I. And so we had, yep, we had that. And so that was good. But she did remarry when I was 9 and had, you know, with John Cation, who's my father now. I kind of look at it as my first father and my second father, not a stepfather or whatever, you know, as a first father and second father. And he adopted both David and I, and then they had another child, so I have a younger sister as well. So, you know, I think one of the things that was hard was that it wasn't really something that was talked about. And I think that was kind of that era, you know, largely. But I do recall in school and stuff, I didn't know anyone else who didn't have a father. And I remember kind of the trauma of, like, Father's Day at school or something like that. And it was like, you know, what am I going to do? Everybody's making something for their dad or a card, and I don't have one. And I kind of think that part of those kind of experiences led me to become a social worker as an adult, to always identify with the underdog, almost to a, you know, to an extreme. I always, you know, identify with the underdog or see people who are, I'm very sensitive to the needs of people.
Who's left, you know, out?
Who's left out. And exactly. And try to, you know, include them. And an irony about the whole thing was, after I got married, when I was 40, and that's a whole story too, I didn't get married until I was 40. Okay, well, I'll tell you a little bit about my career path. So I went to boarding school for a part of high school, and I skipped my senior year because I felt I didn't need to know more, and I just went to night school for civics and summer school for whatever else it was I needed, and graduated a year early. And so then I went on to college at the University of Detroit, majored in social work, and worked with prisoners and autistic children. And then I went to University of Michigan and got a master's degree in social work, specializing in community administration, planning, and evaluation. And I think all of this to me kind of harkens back to losing a parent, you know, because I think that making change, making a difference, using my time well, you know, my time on this earth has always been very important to me. And I think an awareness of when my father died at 30, when I turned 30, it was sort of like, wow, this is as far as he made it. You know, how are you going to live your life to, almost for too, you know, so that whatever I do is, you know, is a measure of his having invested in me, even though if it was only for 5 years. So at any rate, you know, I did that, and then I've had a very successful career, still working, but I worked with Runaway Youth, and was an executive director at age 24, so I really kind of was an achiever, and then ran a statewide children's advocacy organization, and then I set up the Children's Trust Fund for the state of Michigan, and I was in People Magazine, and I was regularly testifying to the legislature and on TV a lot, and I'm saying that not to brag, but to say it was part of the thing of living my life for two, you know, for somebody who couldn't make it that far. Now, my brother, unfortunately, had a different kind of track. He became a drug addict, and he sold drugs, and he became, he went to prison. And I've always attributed some of that to this whole incident, too, that where I always felt like David needed to sort of feed himself, you know, and drugs were the means that he took, where I kind of needed to feed others, and I was very independent. My first daughter I adopted as a single mom, and I didn't get married till I was 40. You know, I saw myself as very independent. In fact, I was telling someone earlier, the last little vestiges that I had after my college fund was spent, I called my FU fund, so that nobody could ever, you know, no man or whatever would tie me down. I was very independent, and I used the last of it for buying a house when I was, I wasn't even 30 yet. So,
nice.
You know, I've had, you know, a good life in that regard. So, but I am still, you know, part of why I wanted to come out here was I know there's still healing that needs to be done. You know, I know there was never really a time of grieving, and anything that was very private. You know, I'm telling you stuff I've probably never told anybody. You know, I recognize now that I'm 65 that this is stuff that still weighs on me, and that I'm glad to have the opportunity to meet other people at this and to sort of figure out some of this legacy stuff, and delighted that the Historical Society wants to do something, you know, and a lot of my skills are in that area, so hopefully they'll be tapped.
This is my sixth interview, and the similarities, what you've just told me, is in every interview.
Right. I'm not surprised.
This is a lifetime journey,
right,
of healing that you will take with you to the end.
Right.
I'm going to be so bold to say so.
Right.
So,
right. Well, and that's something I may want to do something with, you know, as I think about it. I feel like I've had a lot of experiences with grief, you know, starting with my father. And something that was very ironic is, I mentioned I got married at age 40, but my husband died when I was 45. And I had a 4-year-old and a 12-year-old at the time. So it was almost like I got to relive all of this.
What happened to your mom? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I think I felt like I got to do it right. Okay. So I got to be very honest with my kids about the whole thing. I got to, with my younger daughter, we started a little journal about her memories of Daddy. And it was just really, you know, she had memories of, like, we stopped and looked at an owl in a tree. Our daddy drank milk out of the jug. You know, her memories, and she still cherishes that little book. And I kind of wish that I had done that, because, you know, even as you were asking me earlier, a lot of that I was sort of smoothed over, you know. But, so I did handle differently. We're very open about it. You know, the photographs and all I have of my father are, you know, in photo albums, and do have baby movies, so I have those. But a lot of his stuff, for me to bring stuff, it was in suitcases in the storage unit. It wasn't part of my life, you know. And I guess with my kids, I've really tried to make their father be part of their, you know, everyday life. And I think I also, and again, that was a very healing experience for me too, because I felt like I had a choice of crumbling or walking through the flames. And I walked through the flames. And I made more money the year after he died than I'd ever made in my life or never made since, you know. But it was just, it was a motivator, you know, for me. You know, I do think one of the reasons I didn't get married till I was 40 was that I was wanted to be very independent, didn't want to really trust somebody fully, you know, didn't want to, you know, worrying about people leaving. You know, it was kind of easier not to get too close, and you never had to run that risk. So, you know, as I've gotten older, I've gotten more insight into, you know, those kinds of feelings, and you know, and some of that I've translated into work. I've created a life book for foster children, and because I know they needed to put their pieces of their life together, and I want to do that for other, you know, groups of people too, because I do feel so many people live fragmented lives, and particularly when there's a loss or a divorce or an incarceration or a death, you know, so many of those things we just we don't integrate. We just compartmentalize and put into a box and open it now and then, you know, very now and then, because we don't want to feel
That's
that
right.
pain.
That's
But
right.
I don't think we're a whole person or an integrated person until we do make this puzzle whole, you know. And you know, I feel part, that's part of what I'm doing right now, doing this,
Did
coming out
you
here.
ever talk to your mom about what she went through?
A little bit, not a whole lot, because again, I felt even as a small child that I needed to protect her, that I needed to not make her sad, that needed to make things nice and just be a good girl, you know. And you know, I'm sure that it impacted her, you know, greatly. It was a love of her life, you know. And you know, again, I have the remnants of that with you know, their love letters and stuff like that, which is very nice. You know, on that line too, with the loss of a parent, and I'm sure you've talked to other people now that have that too, I cherished any little piece of him that I could find. I still have his bedroom set, and it's been my daughter's bedroom set. I have actually the tie he has on in this picture. I have a couple of his things. I remember very sneakily get, you know, my grandparents kept a lot of his stuff until they died, and you know, he had his golf bag, and I got the pennies out of his golf bag, and you know, stuff like that, because just wanted to keep that intact. It's kind of funny, you know, and I would look for a synchronicity in things. You know, I realized at one point that I had a boyfriend whose inflections were the same as my father's, and it was like, I think that's what attracted me to him, because he had those inflections. My husband now is named Leon, and I never really thought about it, but Leon spelled backwards is Noel, and it's like, do 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 do, you know. You know, maybe some of these things are meant to be. Since I came out on this trip, well, actually, I should just tell you a little bit how I came out on the trip, or why I came out on this trip. I did make a quick trip through the Grand Canyon. I won't say, we stopped at one with a, I had a boyfriend when I was like 21. We were on a camping trip, and we looked at one lookout, and I was so freaked out that I said, I can't stay here. You know, let's go to Bryce. So we did. But I really was fantasizing of, you know, whether my father was still alive, whether he was living with the Indians somewhere, you know, whether you know, all kinds of things like that. Another thing that was pretty profound that happened in my 30s is I did something called holotropic breathwork. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's a means that shamans and stuff like that use to enter an altered state. And so I did this. You do it with kind of in a group usually, but it uses music and breathing. So there's sounds of, you know, drumming and that kind of stuff. And then the therapist is like coaching you in your breathing. And when I did that, I had no idea what was going to do. You know, what I had been told about this that I thought was kind of interesting is that we all operate on, like, you know, 75 RPM, for those of us that remember records, you know, and that this really helps you slow down and really, you know, access things that you couldn't access otherwise, kind of an alternative to LSD, you know, that kind of thing. So I did it, and I had a very, very profound experience where at first I thought I was a rock. And then I thought, no, I'm not a rock, I'm a scarab. And then I thought, you know, I could hear something, and it was like angels singing. And I really felt my father's presence and kind of a voice saying, you couldn't be there for me. Well, I heard the drone of a plane too. And he said, you know, you couldn't be there for me, but others were. And I had a vision of Native American, like, spirit women walking. And I don't know what they were doing, accompanying him to another life or whatever, but it gave me solace. It gave me solace that there's something beyond this. And it gave me solace that there's connections through generations and centuries and souls and all kinds of stuff, you know, that is beyond our understanding. You know, so I did that. But really, it wasn't until the advent of, you know, the internet and computers and all this kind of stuff being so popular that I Googled his name a couple times and found things that he'd written, you know, and that kind of thing. But also found some stuff about the crash, you know, and learned more about that. And, you know, that kind of gave me more questions and stuff. But there was one site, and I'm not sure who it was or what it was anymore, but I commented on how helpful it was to see pictures of the site and, you know, to learn more about it just on this website. And so then I forget exactly what happened, but they put me in touch with another person who had lost her father when she was 4. And she had, she lives in Oregon now, and she had kind of a worse experience than I did, and that, you know, her parents, she didn't even really understand her father was dead for years, or I don't know how long, but so, you know, I felt lucky in that regard, and I felt like I'd had a much happier life all in all, and that things had gone well for me. But you know, I did kind of learn more. And then I think she's the one that told me about Ian and the National Park Service and stuff like that. So that led to my learning. I had never heard that there had been anything before. I didn't know there was a thing.
Yeah.
And so I was very glad to have an opportunity to, you know, to connect with people and to learn a little more. And when I learned about this opportunity for the 60th anniversary, I actually haven't told a lot of people it's the 60th, and I've just said I'm coming out from a commemoration. I don't want people to know I'm as old as I am. But, you know, but it was interesting. I had a lot of people, just as I told people I was coming out here, I put a little thing on Facebook, and people were responding, and my next-door neighbors, when I was a little girl, when he died, both responded on Facebook.
Oh,
and
my
one
gosh.
Remembered that he'd... My dad had built a sandbox and put all of our neighborhood kids' names on it,
oh.
You know, and you know, things like that. So, you know, everybody wishing well and wishing healing vibes and stuff. And I think that is the thing. I feel like I'm going to leave here a fuller person, with maybe some of those puzzle pieces figured out and mashing them into place. There'll probably still be a few missing spaces, but I think I'm gonna be able to move forward.
Well, it sounds like a much better healing journey than when you were 21 or 20.
Right, right, right. And I've loved seeing the Grand Canyon. And as I said, I hadn't really been here before. And I told my husband today, I said, you know, it's sad for me to think that I may leave and may not be back. You know, who knows? There's lots of places in the world I want to see. But, you know, I'll spend another day probably seeing these places.
Good.
Maybe saying goodbye in all kinds of levels.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is your brother still in jail?
No, no.
Has he passed away?
Nope. He has leukemia, though.
Oh, okay.
So he was going to come with me, but then he decided he wasn't up to it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't afford it, so he stayed back. But I bought a book for him, and I want to get him some other souvenirs. And
great.
Took some pictures, and I'll share this whole experience with him. Yep.
Great.
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
Okay. Siblings holding their lives together hasn't always been successful in these, what I've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And suicide, alcoholism, drugs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And and that's something, you know, one of the pieces that I feel like I may be wanting to do more stuff with, in terms of, you know, children's reactions to sudden death and tragic death. Because from just the little bit of talking I've been doing to people or the little bit of writing I've done with this person online, it sounds like some people, I don't want to say make the most out of it, but they kind of do. That they go forward in very healthy and successful ways, which I would say about myself. You know, all in all, I feel like, as I said, I've lived for two. You know, I've really been very resilient and, you know, really had made contributions, I think, you know, I have a legacy to leave, but I also am hearing other people, you know, particularly with alcohol and drugs and stuff like that, and it, you know, it makes me think about PTSD and how maybe that stuff has never really been dealt with, you know, even in the fields of psychology and social work and all that, and that maybe there's some work to be done, and some of this through stories and through art and through, you know, reflections and, you know, all kinds of things. I think that there's lessons to be learned from this. We had a little group meeting earlier than this where we were talking about perhaps the establishment of a foundation or some kind of thing, you know, and somebody talked about we need to look at the lessons learned in terms of, you know, history and aviation and, you know, protecting sites and all those kind of very practical things, but also the lessons learned about, you know, human beings and impact on family and, you know, how people can move forward in healthier ways. And I think that now that many of us are, you know, entering the, I don't know what you call it, the third act of our lives or whatever, hopefully the best acts, who knows, but, you know, that we could really work together and kind of figure some of this stuff out and find a way to share it.
It is a new century, and we do understand debriefing, grief counseling, follow-up, and there are some changes now.
Right.
But one of the things I wrote down on my notes here and put a little box around was the word independent, because that's the one thing I've heard repeatedly from the daughters of the people who passed away, was we didn't have dad. So we learned how to do it ourselves. We changed the tires. We painted the house. We when the tree fell down, we cut it up. We weren't good at it, but we were empowered by that independence. We didn't like it, and I must say it was a lot of fun. But no. But it made it's interesting for me. It made a series of very powerful women women come out of this, which is pretty neat.
I think so. Now, what did you find about men?
The guys. I should say maybe didn't do as well. Everybody's still grieving.
Even after 60 years?
Oh, absolutely.
That surprise you?
Controlling. A lot of the men were controlling, micromanaging, And that could be helpful in their business. A lot of them are very successful. Some not so. Some committed suicide. Some are into drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you see women going into drugs and alcohol too, or not really?
Maybe one, but I've only done 5 or 6 of these interviews. Yeah, and they weren't here. It was this family member telling me about it. It didn't go so well. But it was me. I mean, it hurt everyone, but in our society, it seems like the guys don't have the outreach. Talk about control and support, right?
Right.
At least somebody to, you know, cry on their shoulder. The guys don't do that.
Right.
And so that was...
Are the women crying during their interviews with you?
Well, yeah, it's a box of tissues right there.
Right. How about the men?
I cry a little bit. I try not to. I mean, you know,
I can see you tearing up a little bit.
These are amazing stories.
Do some of the men cry?
The World War II bomber pilot, at the very end of the interview, cried. He said he had never cried over the loss of his brother. But the just put it away and move forward with your lives seems to have come out of this quite a bit. As in 1956, that's what the clergy would come over and say, just forget about it and move forward, or family members,
right,
etc. It seems as though, and help me out with this, because if I was going to paraphrase this, it sounds like Mickey was very fortunate in that just 3 years after she lost Noel, she met
John.
John.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the success stories I've heard, if you could call them success, in quotes, is when the remaining spouse met someone that really cared.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the families taught me that Dad had lost his wife, and eventually he met someone, and they were just waiting behind the door, just waiting for the child to call out Mom, and Dad, she was right there.
Mm-hmm.
And she just really worked hard to make that connection, and then adopted the children, and they were able to bond.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a big part of healing for the children that happened with, but it didn't happen with everyone, and that was tragic.
Right, so, right. That's what I've gathered from being here, that a number of people, their family remained dysfunctional or got more dysfunctional or whatever. And, that's very sad. Because I guess I had hoped and thought that a lot of people would be with me, you know, like me, and maybe stuffing it, which was not good, you know, stuffing the grief so that we wouldn't make others sad. You know, I think there is sort of a sorority or fraternity of people who've had an experience like losing a parent, you know, it's, or people who've lost a child or whatever. It's a different thing than many people experience, you know.
One of the things that Dana Yang taught me yesterday, we did an interview with him and his sister and his mother, Etta, who is here today. It's a wonderful, wonderful woman. He said, at one point I realized that the death of my father was responsible for the FAA, which saved tens of thousands of lives. Did you ever connect that way? Did you ever connect those dots?
Yes, yes, I did. And
was that,
you know,
helpful?
The fact that I feel safe, and I still get scared flying, but that I tell myself lightning's not going to strike twice. You know, it's... you know, there was just a turbulence coming out here, and I was like, oh, boy, you know. Sort of watch over me, too, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people that go through a tragedy, a loss of a parent, don't have that sense of...
Right, of some good coming out of it.
A higher moral change in consciousness of the country that resulted in much...
Right.
More robust safety standards.
I think that's true. And I think that it would be good if that was shared more with people, that had happened. And I think, you know, we need to, I just lived through Hurricane Katrina. And that's another interesting kind of side piece. But Hurricane Katrina, happened a few years ago. And again, when people were talking about how silent things were out at the site, I thought about that Hurricane Katrina was, just you could hear like shutters banging, and everything was brown, and it wasn't colorful anymore. And I took some photographs just in the few days after the city reopened, over in the Ninth Ward. I remember I found a lady's shoe that was like a party shoe, like a high heel, and like laying in the dust. And there was clothing in the trees, you know, and all kinds of stuff. But again, you know, I think even in some ways my father's experience gave me, or my experience with losing a father gave me strength to step forward in that, in my independence. I started something called the Unified Nonprofits of Greater New Orleans, and I also started a incubator for displaced nonprofits, where people who no longer had meeting rooms and boardrooms and training libraries or even a copy machine or fax machine, started that so that people could come use that and, you know, step forward. And then a very remarkable thing that, again, ties into some of this is I was asked by a group in Japan if there were some orphaned children from Hurricane Katrina that I'd like to take to an international grief camp. Now, that dredged up a lot of stuff for me.
I bet.
And I took two African-American boys to an international grief camp in Japan for two summers. It was like 6 weeks each summer. And I was a basket case before I got on the plane. I actually went to a hypnotist to help me get on that thing. And the hypnotist would talk to me about rational fears and irrational fears, and that I was having irrational fears because it did bring out all this stuff about losing a parent. But I was like, these boys had both lost their moms, and one was with her while she was drowning and, you know, hanging onto the curtain rod in their house. And I just thought I had to be strong for these boys. And so I did, and I went to Japan. And while this is interesting, too, while we were in Japan, as a social worker, I was concerned that they didn't have, like, professionals, you know, dealing with these kids. They really were using college students to get kids to talk. And there were children from 18 nations that had lost parents in everything from the tsunamis to the AIDS crisis to Afghan children and Iraqi children. The only other American children had lost their parents in, or a parent in the World Trade Center. So it was a very, very profound experience, but the whole therapeutic model was sharing stories.
Wow.
And as an oral historian, that will interest you. That was it, and it was understanding that you weren't alone, that the kids we sat in circles, and maybe we need to do this with the adults that are here now, but we sat in circles, and each child told what had happened, and, you know, there's sort of survivor's guilt and stuff like that, and that, you know, like a boy, an Indonesian boy, you know, why he had gone to the drugstore for his mom, and when he came back, she was, you know, the house was gone and she was gone and all that kind of stuff. But just the kids listening to each other and learning that they all had these same kinds of feelings, you know, even though the circumstances were different. It was interesting, the Iraqi children were not crying because they were saying, our parents are martyrs, you know, and that we should be happy for them going to heaven. You know, but all the westernized kids and, you know, that kind of stuff are very, very sad. A lot of the Japanese kids had lost their parents to suicides. You know, it was really a very remarkable, life-changing experience for me to go. And I'm so glad I did. And, you know, it's interesting, again, that was 10 years ago. So I haven't thought a whole lot about that other than it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I've made friends all over the world now. And I'm still very close to these two boys who... One is now a journalist for the Times-Picayune, and
wow.
It's a thrill to know that he's, you know, done so well.
Cool.
And, you know, but there, you know, there's all these lessons, you know, about children and grief and sudden tragic loss, you know, and that kind of thing that, you know, there's still work to be done, I think, this whole arena.
Absolutely. Certainly. So 50 years from now, somebody's going to listen to this tape. What else do you want them to know?
I guess sort of courage. Be courageous. Oh, that, you know, whatever bad happens to you may have happened to someone else or something similar. And be open, you know, don't close it off. You know, welcome people to hold you and hug you and listen to you. And, you know, just, you know, kind of be brave, step forward. Grief is not going to, you know, wallowing it is not going to get you anywhere. You know, go forward, you know, in strength and do kind of do what I felt I'm doing for my father, is living well. You know, I think that's an important message, you know, live your best life. So that's what I'd want them to know.
Well, you've done an amazing job.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you. Just think about how much you've done for so many others.
Thank you.
You know, through your father, that's a wonderful, and your mother, of course.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.